Hello, I'm Stephen Rumford, and this is the Life and Death Podcast, brought to you by Ashgate Hospice Care, a series in which we have honest conversations about life, death, and so much more. I've worked in palliative care for over 20 years, and in this series I talk to people who've experiences of death and dying, to try and get a deeper understanding of what life and death means to them. Today's guest is Drew Lilliker, funeral director at Harold Lilliker and Sons in Chesterfield. Drew's is a family business, so he's been around funerals all his life and was able to share some unique insights with me.
If you ever want some good advice, talk to a funeral director, because they've seen a lot of life and they've seen a lot of death, unfortunately. You've seen people that have had it all and lost it all and realised the true value of life.
Drew spoke about his experiences of life and death and the responsibilities of his work. But he began by telling me about his grandfather's business.
I'm Drew Lilliker, a local Chesterfield born and bred guy, born in the village of Hasland to a family funeral directors. So my grandfather was the funeral director, my father, and I grew up around my dad. Sadly, my grandfather had passed away before I was born, but it was my dad's business. He grew it into being a full-time funeral director. For me, it was normal. It was the same as anybody else's upbringing, but just with that twist of it's being around a funeral director that's 24 hours a day, and that's normal to us. It's a different life to others, but to hear, if you don't know any different, then that's it. But all these people that came in and spoke to my dad, I just saw him as nice local people who wanted to come and see my dad. I didn't realize probably what they were all coming here for, but that's it. So from a very young age, you're around it. You wash the big black cars that you think are just normal to have limousines in the car park, and you get stuck in. As soon as you're old enough to carry a coffin, your dad says, "Here's a suit, come and help." And that's the upbringing of a family funeral directors.
Can you remember a time when you became aware of the nature of the work? I mean, you've said it's all very ordinary, and I completely get how that is. You know, you grow up and everything is normal. Was there a sort of growing sense of, you know, that the fact that it is somehow unusual?
A couple of things stick in my mind. One, which is, it will be strange to other people, but one is I can remember seeing my dad driving in a hearse and waving at my dad, and other people looking in horror that I was waving at my dad. And other people wouldn't wave. And that was a strange thing to anybody, but not to me at the time. It's my dad.
You said as soon as you were old enough, your dad had you in a kind of black suit and you were involved in the business. So this is kind of like a Saturday job. I mean, Saturday job equivalent, like you would do stuff.
Well, no, you finish school at 3:30 and you're home shortly after, and the limousines still need washing. And my dad was a very hard-working guy, and then obviously weekends. Yes, you're right. Weekends are there. School holidays, time. I mean, my dad was. It is a true family business here. So when I was a very young age, I'd go to the Yorkshire Bank in Chesterfield, and I'd be lifted up, and I'd sit on the counter and watch them counting money in and out for work, dealing with donation money and things like that. And it was always something. You were just involved. You were here. I mean, I never knew any facts. I never knew any names. That part never was anything that ever existed to me. I always remember, I think it's a great story because it was one that caught me out more than anything. I was at the local church with my children on stage doing a sort of a Sunday school type performance for Messy Church. And somebody tapped me on the shoulder from behind, leant over, and everywhere's quiet. The performance is going on. And this lady who I knew was my old school teacher tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Do your children draw pictures of coffins like you used to?" And the smile on my face will never go, because who would be a school teacher and expect to see a child drawing a picture of a coffin and explain that you were screwing handles on there with your dad on a Saturday morning or after school and expect that to be normal? So the answer is my children do sit on the bench with me, and they do pass me screws to screw into the handles. And we do work on things like that together. So it is the next generation coming through in the same way as we do now.
Fascinating. So obviously early doors, doing the cars, you know, that slight distance from the kind of core business, the nature of what the firm did. Was there a point where you moved into being there, being present at funerals and all of that?
I must have. I look back, I can't remember the exact date, but I was still wearing my school uniform, which was a white polo shirt with a black jumper over the top. and somebody came into our car park, knocked on the office door, and my father was out, and there was, for some reason there was nobody else here. And I answered the door expecting it to be just dropping a letter off or something like that. And somebody said, my father's passed away. Can I arrange a funeral? And I said, yeah, come on in. I'll take a few details. And so my intention was just to answer a few questions, maybe just take the names and things for my father to ring them back. And they asked a lot of questions. I gave them a lot of answers. By the end of it all, we shook hands and they left. And my dad then rang them up later on and arranged a further meeting. They came back the next day to continue the arrangements. And they said, where's the guy we saw yesterday? And he said, oh, my son is at school. And they said, no chance. He's not old. He worked here, didn't he? And they couldn't believe that I was at school age. So Tupton Hill School, you didn't wear school uniform at A-level. So it was before my GCSEs was when I first met with a family and arranged the funeral myself. That's where you start taking the names and the details and being involved in those sort of things. Before that, I was a tall guy. I'm sort of touching 6 foot two. So you could carry a coffin at a young age. I'm sure modern day rules say that my children shouldn't be carrying coffins at 14 or so. But that's what I did in the school holidays. And if you were there, you'd go, and it was experience. There's always something to do, even if it's holding a door open for somebody and welcoming them to a funeral.
I'm curious about what the young Drew felt about being at a funeral in particular. I get the bit at the with the work, the nature of once you're at the funeral home and when you're with family, all of that is totally normalized. I get that. But then you enter these very particular spaces, don't you? Funeral spaces, which are very intense, aren't they? I mean, they're certainly my experience of them is that they're very emotionally intense spaces. And how did you as a young man either manage or what did you make of that, the intensity of that? It's a very particular thing for a young man or a young person to be involved with, I would think.
At the time, you're young, you don't think about it perhaps as much as you probably ought to have done, but you looked to your dad, who's the funeral director, who's the one that people rely on to hold it together, that rely on for the answers. He was a good teacher, so he'd give you set instructions on what you were doing and you'd do that. But then as soon as you are at the age where you are driving and you are able to see people, drive people around and be involved in the real part of the funeral, you do find yourself in those situations where people are obviously very upset and you are there and you are the person that they look to ask the questions and need the answers from. So that's where I think the honest truth is it gets really serious for a funeral director or funeral director in the making at the time. I think the important thing always to remember, if you ever want some good advice, talk to a funeral director, because they've seen a lot of life and they've seen a lot of death, unfortunately. But you've seen it all, met a lot of people from all walks of life in all situations, and you've seen people that have had it all and lost it all and realised the true value of life. The answer to it all is no two people are the same. No two people want the same answer, even if it was the same answer. Everybody's circumstances are different. You've got two ears and one mouth, and you probably ought to use your ears twice as much as you use your mouth. And so you listen to what people really need. And from there, you move things forward for them.
So a point comes when you've decided between you and the family, you're in the business. I wonder, could you say a little bit about a sort of, I know there won't be such a thing, but an average day kind of thing. Like, what's it like being a funeral director from getting in the office to signing off and having your first glass of wine or whatever you do to?
Well, the first thing to answer there is I don't drink. I'm on 24-hour call and you don't have wine. People think a funeral director walks in front of the hearse, or people think a funeral director stands at a funeral in a suit looking smart. I don't think they expect anything more. The average day doesn't exist, you're right in what you say, but if you said to me, describe one, the answer is it's an early start. The day of the funeral, it requires obviously route checks. So as if you're picking a family up from a location, you need to go and see the location. A final check. You've probably done it two or three, maybe 10 times before, but you still need to check because they dig roads up, there's fallen trees, there's all sorts of things that will change. So you need to do that. Timekeeping is always in a massive part of the thing within funeral directing. Most people, I mean, nowadays I use a sat nav, so I've got a satellite navigation system. I know when I'm at, how long it takes me from my car park to the location I'm picking somebody up, so maybe their family home. I know which route I'm going to take, and I've got a clock on the sat navigation that tells me what time I will arrive at the crematorium or the church or the woodland burial ground, whichever location we're going to. When I first started, it was the same way as my father. It was a stopwatch and you timed everything. You've got a certain window to be there. If you arrive 20 minutes early to a funeral, you've got 20 minutes of a family standing there, not knowing what to do. It's too long. It doesn't work. If you arrive late, you've started off late and that doesn't work. You set your watch by a funeral starting. That's a traditional thing. It's always happened and it always will happen. It doesn't matter what changes. That will always remain the same. So that is a huge part. And as I say, you've got to get back. You've got to be in place. You've also got deliveries to consider. So flowers will arrive. You've got to make sure the flowers are in the right place. The coffin is dressed the correct way. Family's instructions are carried out. Their wishes are done. And it is a big big game of chess. The young boy in me loved it when it snowed. The funeral director that's not quite so young anymore hates it because the clock starts ticking when the snow starts coming. I've got scars on my hand from when it snowed about 12 years ago. I dug snow that long that week that I don't think the scars will ever go. You always look back to your father's words, who looked to his father's words, and the answer is, well, you don't cancel the funeral because who says it's going to stop snowing? It could snow next week. It could snow the week after. You carry on. If the family want you to carry on, you carry on. So that's it. If it's a sunny day and the snow's not here, then the sun makes the limousines look terrible. So you've got to keep polishing. And there's always something to do. You don't see many funeral directors sitting around. And it goes on and on and on until the day ends. And the day ends when the work's finished. And if you're on call, the day doesn't end because it's 24 hours a day and the phone could ring in the middle of the night.
Yeah, no, you've certainly managed to communicate that side of it. The other bit that I'm fascinated, maybe I shouldn't fess up to that, is I wonder whether you could talk through the collection of the body. So I know of your firm and I know of other funeral directors, and all I really see is a private ambulance or something branded thus coming to the hospice. What happens when that person's remains leaves the hospice and they come to you?
The bringing somebody into our care, in one sense it's the same wherever you go, but then obviously we have the hospice side. The hospice and hospital side are a particular way compared to the home. The home obviously you receive from a family member, whereas the hospice you receive from somebody who cares for them. But we bring them into our care, obviously, and we use the word care and we use it seriously because it is to look after them. So a private ambulance is the right piece of equipment in a sense, although it's a big piece, to care for them. So it's not just a van, which people sometimes fall into a bit of a trap of and think that's what it is. It's there for a reason. It's got thousands of pounds worth of technology and years of experience to design it to look after your relative. Bringing them back into our care is something that is a huge relief, I think, to a lot of families.
And this may seem really crude, and you speak so eloquently about the whole process. And I know from personal experience the amount of care that your profession gives. Because when my mum died in particular, the funeral director was extraordinary and was absolutely central to managing me. You know, I think for those 2 weeks before the funeral, I was a little bit mad. In that, the world felt different. The world had changed when my mum died. The world looked different. It changed. And I felt really quite different. I felt quite free, actually. But I was also quite emotional at times. And the funeral director, I must say, I thought was like, I don't know, they had the best of everything. They were like a therapist. They were like, you know, a kindly, yeah, benign, wise figure. They held it. They held that space for me remarkably. So when I ask these questions, they're with that level of respect in mind. But I just think it might be interesting for me and for listeners in terms of what's the obligation around things like embalming or how does the body get managed? Can you just leave it be? Do you have to do things? Is this a choice?
No, there's no rules to that. There's no legislation that says that embalming is compulsory or anything like that. And in fact, in most cases, I find it something that shouldn't be done. Our climate in this country isn't Spain or other countries that are very warm and you need to do it. It's a case of everybody's different and it's the care that families want is the answer. There'll always be medical conditions. It's going to be a factor. We can't get away from that, where sometimes an embalming type of process would be recommended. But it's not necessity and it's not needed if you don't want to do certain things. And I mean, embalming is a preservation of the person. It's designed, obviously, to preserve them for the allowance of people to come and see them, to come and say goodbye. If that process is already taken care of, if you've spent time at somebody's bedside at Ashgate Hospice, like so many families do, we do find that sometimes they say, no, we were there. The time we spent with them was truly them. We've seen them to that point, and then from that point on, we know that they were looked after. We know they were peaceful, and we know that they weren't maybe in pain or in suffering. So we don't need any of the extra part, which is the embalming. We don't need that. And so they don't have it. And some companies perhaps will be have a different business model, let's say, and they want to give that to every family and do that. But if it's not right for you, then you shouldn't have it. There's nothing in a funeral rule book that says you need this, 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 and this. I conduct funerals every day, and every single day the funeral will be different. And if somebody says to me, what's the aim of your company? What's the aim of you as a funeral director? I'd say to make funerals different, more different for every person than they ever have been. Because I look back to my grandfather's time, and a funeral was choice A or choice B. And there was no C, and there was no options on A or B. It was maybe a burial or a cremation. Maybe it was a dark wood coffin or a light wood coffin. It was so old fashioned, because that is what the funeral profession is. It's always been behind. It's always been backwards. And that's the important thing, I think, is to move the funeral world, certainly in Chesterfield, certainly where I am here, into a modern sort of look and a modern feel, because the people who are attending the funeral are modern people. The people who are needing the care are modern people. Following traditions such as having somebody embalmed just because, it's not the same. We've got very good equipment now, refrigeration and things like that, that they didn't have 100 years ago, not the same. And so do you need everything the same as you had before? No, you need to have a clear mind. And I think this year, the COVID year, as sort of we've ended up calling it, it's made people really think about what we're doing. And it's never going to be a good thing. This year's been a hard year, but by making you think about things and making you have an open mind and making you change things, it's only a good way in that sense. We now have people who have funerals that have a funeral that's nothing like a funeral that would have been 10 years ago. But if it's right for them, it's right for them. And that's the right answer to that question.
Mm. You mentioned there, you finished there with, you know, mentioning the year we've all had. And I can see how, well, healthcare and then, you know, beyond into your world has been something of a sharp end of it. And I guess it's hard to characterize very simply, but I wonder if you could, if there has been reflections for you over this COVID year, whether you have anything, any thoughts or reflections as a result of it.
I do. You can't get away from it here. We've been a profession. We've been a service to people, but we've always been a service to people that maybe even has been at the end of the odd joke here and there. And when the pandemic came, when the virus was mentioned, I was stopped in the street as the world was shut down and closed, and the businesses were there and people were panicking. And somebody stopped me in the street who said to me, "Oh, I bet you're the only person that's happy about this." And that's the only time I've probably ever wanted to leave this job, because for the pandemic itself to come and the way it came, the frontline people are the ones that suffer. They're the ones that are harmed the first. And I've always said, if there was ever a pandemic, we'll get it. We will get it first. Everybody thinks it's all about profit. My business isn't about profit. My business is, you don't have a family business, live on site, and go to bed at night with the people you live next to, with the businesses that you shop at, and expect to do other things such as like make profit above everything else. The job here is care, and to care for people. And you don't do that by robbing people and moving on. So to have somebody stop me in the street and say, "You're going to be happy about this," was a naive question. And I didn't even really give it an answer. I just sort of said, you've not seen the future like I see it. And I hope it doesn't come like I see it. And the answer to that is it did come like I saw it. It was worse to us than I ever dreamed. It kept me up at night. And the answer it kept me up at night was because I have my family, I have my staff, I have my team. Very early on in the pandemic, one of my team was diagnosed with COVID-19 and at 47 years old died from COVID-19. So for us, it's been hard. You don't get away from that. It'll never leave us. All we get to do is say, well, we have to carry on. We have to carry on for the families that we look after. For the first time, maybe it was a trial, maybe it was just a way of trying to access that, we started a Facebook page. Social media in the funeral world, and you look back a few years and you think that's probably the one decision that I made that my father would have, if it had been here, would have certainly overruled me on and said, no chance, son. You go over there and do something else. I'm in charge. You're not doing that. And we did it. And if we hadn't have got that Facebook page and we hadn't got that mindset of using social media, I don't know whether this year would have worked as well as it did. Because people could grieve in a different way. And it's allowed technology to become part of a funeral, really and truthfully, because most churches in a traditional way, when I look at the start of my career, if you were lucky they had a microphone, basically that was what technology had brought. Whereas now we're looking at live streaming and we're bringing people from all corners of the world to a funeral service without having to travel, which it's never everyone's plan A, but actually sometimes it just has to be that way. But now people can be part of it around the world.
I was going to go on to whether there was anything that you feel, well, actually there's been loads. So it's a ridiculous way to start this question, actually, because there's been loads of stuff that is of the nature of wisdom for people to hear about both the life of a funeral director, or at least your version of your life as a funeral director, but also about some of the greater, the broader wisdom about how we see death and dying. But I just wondered, is there anything that you feel you would like to say, I suppose, really, to listeners around death and dying from the work that you do?
My thoughts are, mine are a very different way to, I think, a lot of funeral directors. A lot of funeral directors just look at what the traditional is and just do the job. Whereas I like to think the trick is not to be kept into a funeral is just. The word just doesn't work in funerals. It's what you want it to be. Don't be scared of the funeral. Be sort of attracted to making it the right thing for somebody. Mm-hmm. And it might be just wearing a flower on a button, or wearing a red tie if they like red, or it can be anything, but just do something.
Mm. Yeah, well, great. Yeah, great. Wise words. I wonder if we could move on to sort of the last little bits of questions, really, which is, you're someone who sees a lot of death. Certainly you see a lot of dead, obviously in your work.
Yeah, I do.
And I wonder whether that, or how has that affected you in reflections and thoughts, quiet moments, when you think about your own mortality?
You don't think about it until somebody asks you it, and then you really think about it. The answer is, my life is different to everybody else's, and so it should be. But it's different in a way that when I drive to a hospital, I have to have a reality check of that the car park at the front of the hospital is far greater and fuller for all those people that go into a hospital who come out and are well. Whereas in my job, I inevitably only deal with the people where it has gone wrong and it's not worked out. So you always have that negativity in your mind that you see somebody with a condition, you don't see the ones that survived a lot longer with it or maybe even got over it. You only ever see the ones that passed away from it. So to me, it can be a very negative and daunting job. Every morning on a Monday morning is somebody else's as name. And you look at that and you do have to have a bit of a shake of the head and go, come on, let's just have a bit of a reality check here. And I use the car park example as a good one, because it is true. All those operations that go on every day do good. And you shouldn't fear a hospital, because people do come out of it all the time. But you do inevitably have to look at your own time. And I look at mine, and time is something I look at all the time for my job. Everything's about time. So I have three sons, and so I have three watches. So when something happens to me, they'll all get one of my watches and things like that. And so I think about things in that way. I always think how bizarre it was that when my father got cancer and was poorly and was told he'd not got long, that we sat down and he said, get a bit of paper or get a pad and we'll talk it through. and everything he wanted was different to what I actually thought he wanted, which we'd fallen into the trap as a family. And that's why I was adamant that I wanted to change things, and people should talk about funerals, even if it's not with me. It's part of every day. And so do I fear passing away? No. I like everybody, I think I fear not doing things that I wanted to do. But do I fear that? No, I don't. I look at what people go through, and you hope that you get a certain choice of, or a certain roll of the dice, I think is the way of putting it. But for some people it works out, some people it doesn't. But you do have to think about it. There's no other way of doing it.
Drew, that was great. That was a really, really full, the whole thing was a really brilliant. I felt like I want to come and work for you. I want to come and work in your funeral home. Sounds great. I mean, you know, it really does, because like I said, and I wasn't being disingenuous, that my experience with my mum's funeral director was profound, really, you know, because he met me in my blubbering wreck. He met me in my sadness. He met me in my grief and didn't flinch, you know, whereas other people, of course, have their own. He seemed to just be able to hold my state.
Yeah.
And I felt ennobled by it. I felt like, well, that was a beautiful thing. It was genuinely beautiful. You know, I don't mean in a... I've already admitted to being mad at the time, so you must take this in the light of the fact that I did feel somewhat disorientated in myself. But it was really precious. Yeah, I have a lot of time for you and your colleagues.
Well, thank you for that. My father used to describe it in two ways. He used to say, a wait will build. Before the funeral, a wait will build. And if you've got a good funeral director there, the funeral director will tell you it will be okay. And all the way for those 2 weeks of somebody saying it will be okay, that makes that manageable, only just, but it makes it manageable. But the second you walk out of that funeral, a weight is lifted because it's over, it's done. And you can close that chapter to a degree. You never lose the book. You can always go back and reread it, but you've closed it for now, and you can look to the future, and you can remember the happy times, and you can move things on.
You have been listening to the Life and Death Podcast with me, Stephen Rumford, brought to you by Ashgate Hospice Care. Thank you to Drew for chatting with me, and thank you very much for listening. If you've been affected by anything you've heard in this episode, you can head to our website, ashgatehospicecare.org.uk, for links and support. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate us and leave a review on Apple Podcasts and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love you to ask us any questions or share your experience of death and dying in your review, or let us know on our socials, Ashgate_hospice on Twitter and Ashgate Hospice Care on Instagram and Facebook.